This is Voices from Appalachia Radio Show, sponsored by the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Shepherd University. I'm Brian Staggers, and here's your host, Bianca Eisen.
Traditional songs tie communities together, both in their shared experiences and to their sense of place. Around the turn of the 20th century, there was concern that many English ballads were on the verge of being lost to history. Today we'll be hearing from Dr. Benjamin Bankhurst about the English folklorist Cecil Sharp, who traveled through the mountains of Appalachia in search for remnants of English ballads. Dr. Bankhurst teaches courses in history and Appalachian studies at Shepherd University.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for having me on the program. I guess what I want to do today is to talk about a figure who I'm greatly interested in, English folklorist Cecil Sharp and his four trips to the southern mountains between 1916 and 1918. But before I introduce you to Cecil Sharp, I do want to talk about why he's important, but how I talk about his trips and his influence on how Appalachia is perceived from the outside within the context of my lectures and my class discussions here at Shepherd. So traditionally, I use him and his view of the region as one end of a spectrum through how many outsiders view the history and cultural significance of the region to modern American culture. Appalachia, I believe, more than many other regions in the country, is a place defined largely from the outside, from the perspective of those who live outside its boundaries. Historian John Williams remarks that Appalachia, more than most of the regions into which the United States is customarily divided, is a territory of images, a screen upon which writers, artists, and savants for several generations have projected their fears, hopes, regrets, and enthusiasms about America, present and past. Folklorists, industrialists, and hippies have all viewed the region as a place of contradictions. For some, it represents a pre-industrial pastoral paradise, a place untouched by the corrupting influence of modernity. It is a region that represents the essence of America, a place where we might visit in order to rediscover who we are as a nation. For others, though, it is a place apart, a foreign and backwards place, populated by ignorant and violent bigots. It therefore represents a nightmarish counter-narrative to the optimistic vision of the country's progressive future. So today, we won't talk about that second narrative, the negative stereotyping of the region. Rather, I want to talk about the cultivation of a more positive, though flawed, image of the history of Appalachia, its people, and its culture, one that was perpetuated by an Englishman, Cecil Sharp, in the early decades of the 20th century. Sharp, among others, saw Appalachia as unchanging and pastoral, as a sort of pre-industrial Arcadia in which the simple lifestyles of days gone by continue to thrive. Those who live here are ennobled and virtuous. They are, due to their isolation, the guardians of threatened folkways and traditions destroyed elsewhere through the process of industrialization. This, again, is Cecil Sharp's Appalachia. Before we get to Sharp and Appalachia, though, I think it might be healthy or helpful, I should say, as a means of introduction, to quickly go over perhaps the most often quoted outsider observation about the people and culture of the Southern Mountains, a line from an op-ed published in The Atlantic magazine by William Goodall Frost in 1888. In it, Frost comments on the manner and appearance of mountain people, which he described as living in the, quote, pioneer stages of social development. He visited the region on the eve of one of the great coal booms in eastern Kentucky and southern West Virginia. And he said this, and this again, this line has stuck with us. It comes up, I mean, if you take any his class on Appalachian culture and history, you've heard this line before, but it's worth going over it because I think this gets us at Cecil Sharp's view of the region. And Frost says, quote, A little sympathy and patience are necessary if we would recognize these marks of civilization of our contemporary ancestors, through the exterior of which is at first sight somewhat rude and repellent. So it's not starting off with a great, great view of the people of the region. He continues, the characteristics thus far noted are only on the surface. It will require still more insight and imagination to really know the heart of a mountain man. As in external matters, the great characteristics is, quote, going without things. So in the realm of ideas, we are first impressed by the immense blank spaces. Can you divest your mind of those wonderful ideas which have been born since the revolution? And here he's referring to the American Revolution. And have expanded and filled the modern world, evolution, and the rest? Appalachian America may be useful as furnishing a fixed point which enables us to measure the progress of the moving world. And it's the opening line is what Frost's op-ed is most well known for. He says that we go to Appalachia to meet our contemporary ancestors. So it's worth thinking about what he means there. What does it mean to have a contemporary ancestor? And there he means, I often talked, when I talk to students about this, we kind of frame it like Colonial Williamsburg, right? You go to a place and you meet people who are living life as it was once lived, right? And so I think from his perspective, as an outsider, he views that the life and the culture of Appalachian people as a window into the American past, right? And in some ways, I mean, obviously this is deeply flawed, but nonetheless, this becomes a very useful way of thinking about how outsiders saw the region in the late 19th century. Now let me introduce you to Cecil Sharp, a man who kind of held a similar sort of view of the region and its culture. A man whose thoughts on Appalachian culture continue to influence how both residents and outsiders see the region 100 years after they were first articulated. So Cecil Sharp, born in 1859, dies in 1922, was an English ethnomusicologist and folk song collector. He was central to the first folk song revival of the early 20th century and is personally responsible for the collection, curation, and ultimately the survival of thousands of English folk ballads. He founded the English Folk Dance and Song Society in London, and an organization that remains at the forefront of the interpretation and preservation of English folk culture. You know, I can list his accomplishments in England over and over again, but I'm sure our listeners here have come to hear about Appalachia and Appalachian history, not English folk ballads. So how does this English folklorist become interested in the culture of the Southern Mountains? Let's talk about sort of Sharp's background here. Sharp came from what we might call a lower middle class family. His father was a slate merchant. This is important because throughout his life, he was dependent on outside patronage. He was not independently wealthy, like many of his contemporaries. He therefore often concealed his emerging socialist beliefs. We must remember that Edwardian England, the England in which he lived, was a rather conservative place. It was a place of conservative reentrenchment throughout most of his career. Now let's talk about his politics. Sharp had heard the lectures of William Morris and had become a Fabian socialist, which is to say that he supported political and cultural reform in England toward the goal of establishing a more equitable social country. So let's quickly talk about Fabian socialism and William Morris. William Morris is, of course, most famous as kind of the leading light in the arts and crafts movement, but he also is a committed socialist reformer. Sharp is attracted to Fabian socialism because it is sort of a gradualist approach to reforming English society. He longs for a society in which the culture of the English working classes is, I guess for lack of a better word, he longs for a society in which the English working classes can reconnect with their pre-industrial past as a way of empowering them in the present. Now, the world in which Sharp has begun his career is a world marked by industrialization. Now, Great Britain had undergone the Industrial Revolution in the late 18th century and continued to industrialize through the 19th and into the 20th century. So it had been over 100 years since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. England at that time was also a highly urbanized society with great cities like Birmingham and London, and also further north, places like Newcastle and in Scotland, Glasgow, were industrial centers that had drawn the local rural population into an industrial workforce. This had led, in Sharp's opinion, to a disconnection among the English working classes to the culture of their ancestors. They had become too distant from the pastoral culture that had dominated throughout most of England's history. And in consequence of that, they had begun to lose a sense of their own self-worth. Theirs was the culture of the city, and that culture was often dictated to them, in Sharp's estimation, by sort of a bourgeois cultural class. He saw this as very problematic, and he longed to assist the English working classes in making connections to their ancestral inheritance through folk ballads and folk song. So that's how he became sort of a folklorist and a ballad collector. Once the working classes recognized their self-worth through this engagement with their history, they would demand change. That is Sharp's sort of main objective in trying to collect a bunch of this material, namely ballads, pre-industrial ballads. As he collected songs in England, he became concerned that a great deal of material from the oral tradition had been lost forever. In the early 1910s, he heard from correspondents in America that some English ballads had been discovered in the Southern Mountains. So between 1916 and 1918, Sharp traveled to the mountains of Virginia, Tennessee, and North Carolina on a mission to record and preserve English folk songs so as to fill in the gaps in the record back home. And over the course of those 2 years, he made four trips into southern Appalachia in order to record ballads from the local population. Now, it's important to remember here that Sharp always had as his guiding light here the documentation of English ballads that then could be re-imported back home. So because the process of industrialization had ripped the English working classes from the land, because they had lost so much over the succeeding 100 years, there was a lot in the record that had not survived. So the goal of Sharp going to the Southern Mountains was to record old English ballads in order for them to be reintegrated into school curricula and republicized back home in England. That's what he was looking for.
Cecil Sharp collected well over 1,000 ballads during his trips through communities in the Appalachian Mountains. One of my personal favorites is The House Carpenter, performed now by Flora Meeker, the same Flora Meeker who composed the music used on this program.
Well met, cried an old true love. Well met, cried he. I've just returned from the salt, salt sea. It's all for the love of thee. Well, I could marry the king's daughter dear. I'm sure she'd have married me. But I have forsaken those crowns of gold. It's all for the love of thee. Well, if you could have married the king's daughter dear, I'm sure that you are to blame. For I am married to a house carpenter, and I think he's a fine young man. Oh, will you forsake your house carpenter and come along with me? I'll take you to where the grass grows green on the banks of Sicily. Oh, what do you have to maintain me upon to keep me from poverty? Well, 7 ships all on dry land and 7 more upon the sea. She picked up her tender little babe, and kisses she gave him 3, saying, stay right here with your father, dear, keep your father company. She's dressed herself so fine in the silk, so glorious to behold, that every town that she walked down, she shines like the glitter and gold. They hadn't been gone but 2 long weeks. I know that it was not 3 when our old lady, she began to weep. She wept most bitterly. Oh, are you weeping for your house or your land, or yet for your native shore? Or are you weeping for your house carpenter, whose face you'll never see no more? Oh, I'm not weeping for my house or my land, nor yet for my native shore. Oh, I am weeping for that tender little babe, whose face I'll never see no more. They hadn't been gone but 3 long weeks. I know that it was not 4 when their own ship, it sprung a leak and sank to the ocean floor. What hills are those, my love, as white as any snow? Oh, those are the hills of heaven, my love, where all good people go. What hills are those, my love, as black as any crow? Oh, those are the hills of hell, my love, where you and I must go.
Let's get back to our lesson on Cecil Sharp with Dr. Bankhurst.
So what were his goals on this southern journey? He is quite explicit in the introduction to English folk songs of Southern Appalachians, which is his collection of songs that he published after his trips to Appalachia. In it, he dictated that the point of this was to bring these songs home. Now, that book, English Folk Songs in the Southern Appalachians, was, to put it simply, a sensation. It was a publishing success at the time and would go through 2 editions before the Second World War. In many respects, it revived the reputation of American balladry and implanted a positive image of the mountaineer in the consciousness of educated Americans. Now, just something to remember here, the reigning view of Appalachia from the outside was not a good one. It was a very negative view of the region that had come into existence through the local color newspaper scene, in which visitors would go and comment on the culture of different places in America. And also, it was a view that was colored by the recent notoriety of certain feuds, namely the Hatfield-McCoy feud on the Kentucky-West Virginia border. So by and large, there wasn't much stock put in the cultural worth of Appalachia within the United States as a whole in the early 1920s. Sharp kind of changes a lot of that. And when he goes to the mountains, he's pretty explicit as to why he's there. And he observes that the people of Laurel country around Madison County in western North Carolina, he says the following, quote, "The present inhabitants of the Laurel country are the direct descendants of the original settlers, who are emigrants from England, and I suspect the lowlands of Scotland." He always begrudgingly says, yeah, and Scotland. I mean, this comes up all the time. How many years prior to this the original emigration from England had taken place, I am unable to say. But it is fairly safe, I think, to conclude that the present-day residents of this section of the mountains are the descendants of those who left the shores of Britain sometime in the 18th century. The region is, from its inaccessibility, a very secluded one. There are but few roads, most of them little better than mountain tracks, and practically no railroads. Indeed, so remote and shut off from influence were, until quite recently, these sequestered mountain valleys that the inhabitants have for 100 years or more been completely isolated and cut off from all traffic with the rest of the world. Their speech is English, not American. They are English, not American. End quote. I mean, that, so that again comes from the introduction to English folk songs of the Southern Appalachian. And what I hope to instill in listeners here is that he's going with a very particular view of the of mountain culture and its worth from the onset. He's looking for English balance, and by God, he finds English balance at the expense of other forms of balladry and other forms of folk song that he encounters in the mountains. Critics, when his collections were published, raved about the collection and its reprint. And I'm going to read a few of them just to indicate how transformative this book was to the reputation of Appalachia within sort of educated Northeastern academic circles in the early 20th century. Richard Aldrich said of the English folk songs in the New York Times in December 1918, quote, attention was called last season to the fact that these ballad collectors, he's referring to Sharp among others, have recently had the invaluable reinforcement of Cecil J. Sharp, the chief authority of the on English folk song. Two summers he has now spent in the mountainous regions of the South. He has made discoveries and amassed collections that will necessitate some important and thoroughgoing revisions of previously accepted ideas about English and Scottish and American folk song and the living survival of that song. It must be remembered that these results were gained in America, where it was thought hopeless a few years ago by the chief authorities on the subject of folk song and ballad to look for anything of this kind. Instead of this being the case, folk singing of this sort flourishes here in the Appalachian region. It is quite within bounds to say more vigorously than anywhere else in the world. Songs and ballads survive here that are completely extinct in England, and that the surviving folk singers there knew not of. So again, right, there's worth to this culture, right? Suddenly, Appalachia is a place in which these vestiges of pre-industrial culture, but vestiges of Elizabethan or Georgian England survive into the present. It's worthy of preservation. Sharp is responsible for a positive reevaluation of the mountains and its people. He is also responsible for creating the enduring myth of the Southern Mountains as an unchanging place, a region frozen in time, where we might commune with our quote-unquote contemporary ancestors. But who is the our in that phrase? Indeed, who are the we who turn to the mountains searching for meaning and the wisdom of ages now past? Let's take a look at what Sharp got wrong about Appalachia. It should be noted that he's responsible for creating this vision, I think, which is still quite dominant in in the American imagination of Appalachia as a white place, and that's principally where he got things wrong. So, just we must remember that Sharp was looking for ballads, and ballads he found, English ballads. And those were what he discovered. He was not looking for Pentecostal hymns, banjo tunes, or the blues. In fact, he went out of his way to avoid these sorts of song. In so doing, he grossly underplayed the influence of black culture on Appalachian music and culture. When one looks at the demographics of Madison Valley, the country in which Sharp did much of his collecting at the time of his visit, it is true that it was overwhelmingly white. About 2-3% of Madison County in 1910 was black. And it seemed that by the time we get to 1920, the county was getting whiter. That said, these mountain communities were well acquainted with black culture through personal experience and with African Americans, and because of the centrality of towns like nearby Asheville to the local economy. It's not this wasn't the isolated world that Sharp claimed it was. Mountaineers in these areas would routinely engage with local market towns and a local economy beyond their borders. And they also routinely engaged with the cultural world beyond their borders, including black music, among other forms of culture. Mountain music, therefore, encapsulated a great deal of material from the black tradition. And this, of course, Sharp ignored. Sharp, it should also be known, was a man of empire. He had spent a lot of time in Australia, so he brought that luggage to bear in Appalachia. He had a particularly dismissive and racist view of black culture. on numerous occasions through his journals, which survive and have been published by the Vaughan Library the library at the English Folk Song and Dance Society in London, the Cecil Sharp House. And I encourage users or listeners, I'm sorry, to go and take a look at these journals because they are freely available on the website. On a number of occasions, he encounters black people coming out of towns, and he turns to his colleague Maude Carpellies and says, well, we're not going to find what we're looking for there, so let's turn around, right? So he's clearly ignoring black culture in the mountains. He also harbored outright racist views of African Americans, as evidenced by a letter he wrote in 1917 from Winston-Salem. And I'm going to read this letter to illustrate kind of his racist view of African Americans. It is edited. He uses language that I would very derisive, and I will not repeat here. But Cecil Sharp, speaking of Salem, he says, "It is a dull, ugly sort of a place, with a square in the middle of which stands a town hall, quite the ugliest building I've ever seen." He then says that the place was primarily populated by black men and women. He then concludes his letter of disgust about Winston-Salem by saying, "This is a noisy place, quote, and the air impregnated with tobacco, molasses," and he uses an N-word to describe African Americans. So, as you can see, he doesn't put much weight in the cultural value of African Americans in the mountains. So, therefore, his view, his very whitewashed view of Appalachia, which comes to dominate the conversation, I think, on a national scale following the publication of English Folk Songs in Southern Appalachians, is one that completely ignores very important aspects of Appalachian culture and history. So it's a very flawed world that Cecil Sharp creates. But I think it's a mixed bag. In conclusion, I would say that Cecil Sharp does lead many to reevaluate the region and many of the stereotypes that they harbored about his people. But in so doing, and he elevates one group at the expense of others. So we're still, in many respects, living in Cecil Sharp's world, in that the average American, when they think of Appalachia, views it as a white space. And that, I think, is down to the worth that he placed in the ballad tradition of people of English and, begrudgingly, in his opinion, Scottish descent in the Southern Mountains.
That was Dr. Benjamin Bankhurst on the English folklorist Cecil Sharp, who made various treks through the Appalachian Mountains in search of English ballads. Dr. Bankhurst teaches courses in history and Appalachian studies at Sheppard University. You can learn more about Cecil Sharp by visiting the Vaughan Williams Memorial Library at vwml.org. Thank you so much for joining me, and until next week, I'm Bianca Eisen.
Voices from Appalachia Radio Show is sponsored by the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Sheppard University, with the following created to enhance and develop the cultural and economic life of West Virginia and the Appalachian region. Academic programs that include an Appalachian Studies minor, an interdisciplinary BA, BS undergraduate degree, and a graduate certificate and master's degree in Appalachian Studies at Sheppard University. Celtic Roots and Global Appalachia Study Abroad and Celtic Heritage Series. The Appalachian Heritage Writers in Residence and Writers Award, which support the West Virginia Center for the Books, One Book, One West Virginia, Common Read Selection. The West Virginia Fiction Competition. The Anthology of Appalachian Writers, an annual anthology featuring writing by the Heritage Writer, and poetry, fiction, creative nonfiction, essays, and photography created by Appalachian writers across the region and the world. Voices from the Misty Mountains, NEH, and West Virginia Humanities Council Teacher Institutes, Sheppard Speaks StoryCorps Project, and this radio show, in cooperation with Sheppard University Public Radio Station, WSHC-FM. To learn more about our degree programs or upcoming events, visit us at our website at sheppard.edu/appalachian, or at our Facebook page, Appalachian Studies Program at Sheppard.